Hello, my name is Raj Mehta, and I'm joined with Richard Lehman on Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
I'm fine, thank you. Here in England, it's getting cold and windy, and I'm sure it is in very many places in the States as well, especially Chicago with all those cardiologists in it. It's bound to be windy. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But it's windy there anyway. Yes, so today we're going to discuss an article that I was nudged into writing some 7 years ago. Which has the title 10 Commandments for Patient-Centered Treatment. Now, 10 Commandments, as you know, is the set of rules that the Bible says were given to Moses on Mount Sinai by God, engraved on stone tablets. And I don't want to offend any religious listeners, let alone put myself in the position of God in relation to patient-centered treatment. But it came about through quite a long process of discussion with various colleagues, notably John Yudkin, who is a professor of medicine retired from University College London, whose specialty was diabetes. And we had lots of nice conversations together, and he wrote a nice paper with Victor Montori, who many of you will know. I remember him ringing me up one day and saying, "We want to write about surrogate endpoints in trials, these magic figures which patients are told are terribly important, really more important than how they're feeling or how long they're going to live, provided they've got these surrogates right. We can tell them exactly what to do and what drugs to take from the basis of randomized controlled trials." And of course, he didn't believe this, nor does Victor Montori. And so he said, "What's the word for this? What this business of setting up an idol, idol in place of the true aim of the process?" And I said, "Idolatry." And he said, "Idolatry, of course, yes, the golden calf in the books of Moses, that all the Israelites were worshipping while Moses was receiving the true commandments on Mount Sinai." And so after he'd written that article, he asked me if I could follow it up with the Ten Commandments. And we called in James McCormack, who's been a wonderful exponent of patient-centered evidence-based medicine, and a couple of his colleagues, and we wrote this piece really in a fairly light-hearted way for the back pages of the British Journal of General Practice. Now, it's actually one of the biggest hitting articles ever produced by that journal, I'm told. I've never looked at the metrics, but I'm told that's the case. And I suppose it, from my point of view, it was going to be my summary of all that I believed in before I shut up and let others take over. I was 67 at that time, and I thought that would be my last word. But unfortunately for me, and possibly for you, it was not my last word. And so now we're going to revisit this 7 years later and see how it shapes up. So Raj, pull me through it and tell me what you disagree with.
I love the background, and the context is super important. I'm doing my best trying not to laugh out loud as you're describing your attempts to get the last word in. Hopefully we'll have many more last words from you yet, Richard. I didn't realize the context of how you'd written it. It makes sense that you've kind of focused on these patient-centered treatments in parallel with this concept of how to interpret surrogate measures and the pros and cons. And I think it's something we'll have to go through as we go through each of these. But I have found this really valuable. It's something I remember reading when you first published it back in 2015, and I thought it was great, and I shared it with all my students and residents. And I think it really does help center important concepts in a way that's lighthearted, fun, and doesn't get bogged down too much in technical language, which is very important for students and learners, because these concepts should be at a core, and it should be something we can express to anyone in everyday language. So we have 10 of them. And I think perhaps we should start by reading the first one, and you can give us your thoughts on it. Does that sound okay, Richard?
Yeah, fine.
So the first commandment is, thou shalt have no aim except to help patients according to the goals they wish to achieve.
Yeah, okay. Well, this commandment grew out of the work of the Dartmouth Center for Shared Decision Making, notably Al Mulley and Glenn Elwin, who said that you mustn't just diagnose the medical condition, you must diagnose patient preferences. These preferences can be listed, of course, and measured, and then you can compare treatment against them. But they also vary, and they're very much part of the human encounter, dialogue that takes place between us and our patients. So this is really saying, all very well to know about the effects on mortality and the morbidity that's measured in EBM, but maybe that doesn't match entirely with what the patients are looking for. And unless you align yourself with those aims, then you risk giving them treatments that are not of any interest to them, or do not help the conditions which they, or help achieve the aims which they're most concerned with.
That's a great summary. We've spoken of this before, but one of the great values of primary care is that longitudinal relationship with patients that really helps us set the stage for their preferences and kind of understanding this over time. And a lot of EBM is taking trials, you know, the primary endpoints, what are the meaningful differences and benefits they found there, and doing our best to translate that for the patient we're taking care of, and making sure that they align and match their goals and preferences. And if it doesn't, to then walk through that. The flip side of that is then, when research is being designed, can it be designed in a way that keeps in mind outcomes that patients care about? Because certainly mortality is an important one that we would all share. But there are specific ones in different diseases that pertain to quality of life that can be value. And those things are challenging to measure sometimes, challenging to translate, and certainly an area where work needs to be done.
Yeah, I don't want to go on too long about the each particular item. We've got about 3 minutes for each of them. But this goes back right into a hinterland, which involves debates about statins and how much doctors ought to press them on patients, when it's actually very difficult to explain risk to patients. And this is something that we come to later on in these commandments. It's also slightly anti-public health in that, you know, it's very easy to tot up the death toll of a disease or its burden on a health system or whatever you measure, and then say, well, why don't GPs do more to stop this particular condition, detect this particular condition, prevent this particular condition, refer this particular condition? And you can do that right across the whole of medicine. And on that basis, we do terribly badly, especially in the UK, where there are so many disincentives to spend a long time with patients and do a lot of tests. So it's a good introductory commandment, but I think now we ought to move on to the rest of them. Okay.
Our second commandment, number 2, is thou shalt always seek knowledge of the benefits, harms, and costs of treatment and share this knowledge at all times.
Yep. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of people on the ground around the world, and one of the biggest considerations is, in fact, the cost of treatment. You can't discuss treatments even in most US insurance systems, let alone in India or Africa, without talking about the cost and whether the patient can actually bear that cost. So it's useless talking about these wonderful SGLT2 inhibitors that we've been discussing in various episodes if patients can't afford them. And so this becomes a global political question as well as a matter of face-to-face encounters with individuals. And it's also a challenge to us to know these facts, and we can't keep them all in our heads. The harms and benefits of treatments need to be accessible to us so that we're not giving false information to our patients because we haven't got a clear idea of our own and we don't want to lose face. So I think this commandment is really, as the Ten Commandments themselves were when they were first given, an injunction to change people's minds and attitudes so that they are inclined to obey the right path in life or in medicine. And so this commandment goes quite deep and requires a whole new infrastructure to support discussions with patients.
It's something I think is greatly aided by technology, of course. The internet, point of care things to provide us with information. But even with all that technology, it's still overwhelming sometimes to find the information we need for our particular patient and then individualize those considerations of benefits, harms, and costs. And sharing is definitely a challenge.
It is. And at the point this was written, there was a website, I think it was called Know the NNT or something similar. And I had colleagues over here in the UK who were trying to imitate that, and they had some traction with NICE, our guiding body, as to what we can and can't prescribe in the UK. And these discussions have continued. There are more web resources, but until there is sort of one click sat nav for doctors telling them exactly these facts, then we're short of the mark. And that, of course, applies across medicine. I think the people who've done the most towards this are actually the Magic App group, led by Thomas Agaritsas. And they produce some fabulous aids, but they are models rather than a complete coverage. You know, they've designed a wonderful locomotive and a railway system that runs for about 15 miles compared with what the world needs in terms of coverage over 1,500,000 miles. So this is again a simple commandment that leads deep in that direction too.
I'll add one final point before we move to the next one. And I think when dealing with things related to numbers, number needed to treat, and benefit, it certainly would be helpful to have precise knowledge, but sometimes perfection can also be the enemy of success. And even if we only have a general vague idea of how big the benefit might be or the harms might be, even sharing that limited knowledge is still hugely beneficial to patients. So I don't think we should feel compelled to only do it if we know the exact numbers. We can be honest about our uncertainty as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, those numbers apply to the populations in the trials and not to the person in front. So let's move swiftly on to number three, or we could spend a whole podcast discussing that.
Number three is, thou shalt, if all else fails, or if the evidence is lacking, happily consider watchful waiting as an appropriate course of action.
Yes, that commandment got rather lengthy in the process of being discussed between the five authors, so that's why it's slightly clunky, and I don't think we need spend much time on that because it explains itself. We have talked about the test of time in diagnosis. We can talk about the test of time with treatments. We can suggest courses of action, of course, which are non-pharmacological. And So I don't think we will be punished by the deity of medicine if we do nothing in certain circumstances. End of story.
Number four, we have, thou shalt honor balanced sources of knowledge, but thou shalt keep thyself from all who may seek to deceive thee.
Yes. Now, I don't know if people are accustomed to the language of the King James Bible, which was produced in the early part of the 17th century, when Shakespeare was at his most active. It was compiled by a committee of 60 people. It's the best product any committee has ever produced, because it's a fantastic translation, but it is beginning to fade away. And my generation in England was brought up with the King James Bible, which we called the Authorized Version, and it had all these thees and thous and honors and things in it, which perhaps strike a modern reader who hasn't come from that background as a bit weird and contrived. The odd thing in the Ten Commandments is that there is one of them that tells you to have an attitude rather than do stuff. And that is, you're supposed to have an attitude of honor towards your parents, thy father and thy mother. And that's attached to a promise by God that he will keep thee in the land which the Lord God hath given thee. And so we're talking here about an attitude of reverence towards those who provide us with the truth in medicine. But I'm also implying that we should have less reverence for those who try to deceive us by all the means that are available in the modern world of deception. So in a way, this is pro-EBM, and you could say a little bit anti-pharma, because with the best will in the world, which sometimes is there, pharmaceutical companies have to promote their products. That's their goal. And most of them do this very ethically. And I think the standard of big pharma research is generally excellent, but there may be little bits of nudging all along the way in terms of the comparators chosen for those trials, and the way that the results are reported. For instance, increasingly now we have p-values that are actually above 0.5 being ignored in favor of a narrative that says this could still cause benefit, and this is particularly rife in oncology. So if we're looking after patients with cancer, we have to be very careful about accepting little glimmers of hope which may be delusive, and being honest with ourselves and our patients as to how big these effect sizes are. I'm choosing cancer as a particular example because it's very important, but it applies across the board. So without being too moralistic, I think I should shut up really and just say, do good EBM, be critical, but not cynical. Look out for what's new and best for your patient, but be very certain that it honestly is a more likely treatment to help them than any that have gone before.
I think it's good to have a call to integrity. Certainly, we want to be cautious of any influences, intentional or unintentional, is often the case, that might bias us. And I agree, our goal is not to be anti-pharma. We can equally be concerned about academics with intellectual conflicts, hospitals, you know, specialists or procedures where there's an incentive sometimes to believe things will work, and that can make it tricky. I also think it's important to point out that having integrity and being critical doesn't imply we should also be trying to do everything solo ourselves. There's still value in having colleagues and consensus. And we don't want to be nihilistic, but we don't also want to think only I know the truth, you know, and going that way.
We can think of some examples of that, but we won't mention. on to number five.
Number five, thou shalt treat according to the level of risk and not to the level of risk factor.
Now, believers listening to this, do you follow that? It took me a while to twig, and it still doesn't fully resonate with everybody in the medical community that you can have a risk factor, but it may be not the main goal for helping a particular patient because it's outweighed by other considerations and the effectiveness of treatments that are aimed at other factors which could cause them ill health and death. For instance, we're in diabetes. If you have a diabetic person who has an HbA1c that's running between 9 and 10, let's say, but he, in this case, is smoking and has a blood pressure of, let's say, 143 over 92 at the last measurement. Probably the most useful drug there is no drug at all or a smoking cessation product. The second most useful might be either a statin or a blood pressure lowering agent, and they need both. And then the last consideration in that circumstance would be this somewhat too high blood sugar. The patient himself would probably put it the other way around and want more treatment for his sugar. I'm just giving you a simple example here. We could argue about this, and people do whenever you put an example up like that in a lecture. Everybody starts going off on a tangent about diabetes, you know, what levels we should be trying to achieve here and there and everywhere. And we'll come on to that in the next section. But the fact is that we should do two processes with patients we're treating long term. And we should be quite explicit and take them along with us. And this can take time. We should aggregate their risk by finding out all these things about smoking, about cholesterol levels, which I haven't mentioned there, about sugar levels, not just by a single measurement, but by a sequential measure. We should look at their diet. We should look at their degree of exercise, their weight, and so forth. So we aggregate all those together, and we come up with some kind of figure. Taking that risk as a whole, we look at the risk reduction figures of each treatment we're given. Now, this sounds hopelessly complicated, but I think we should try and do it. Since when I'm trying to design a diabetes system for Chinese primary care, I'd like to see these kind of things done. But it's an overload for the patient and for the doctor in a way, because then you have to disaggregate. As I was saying, you have then to look at the trials and see how much they reduce risk in those populations. It becomes arithmetically incredibly complicated. In fact, it's mathematically impossible for an individual to know their risk. Risk, by definition, is just risk. It's not actually facts. So it takes us into this very murky area. But I'm trying in this section to say, let's not kid ourselves. We ought to, that's the way we ought to think about life, as a complex collection of different factors. And all the while we have to live in this soup of different ingredients, or this conflict of different forces acting on us. And so let's not kid ourselves that just because one risk factor is elevated, it's necessary to concentrate on that risk simply because it's simple and the narrative is much simpler.
I really love this commandment or this principle, because I think it gets to the heart of risk and prediction, because it's really about prediction at the end of the day. And trying to predict what harms may come to our patient, and just saying, you know, don't lose the forest for the trees. Don't get focused just on one risk predictor or one or two, because they're easy to measure and easy to treat. Consider all the predictors, all the risk factors, whether they're smoking, whether there are other issues in family and life and so on. And then once you have a holistic idea of all the predictors, all the risk factors and their overall risk, then you can kind of get a sense of where they're at, and have a better idea of which interventions are really most likely to help them. And that's sometimes more challenging to do and measure, but I think it's super important and super important to keep in mind that we want to be looking at all those predictors, not just the one that's easy to measure and easy to treat.
Yeah, and that takes us on to the next commandment, which is?
Number 6, thou shall not bow down to treatment targets designed by committees, for these are but graven images.
Yeah, here we go, very biblical. I just mentioned the golden calf, which is called a graven image. And one of the commandments that thou shalt not make unto thee any graven images is the reason why a lot of the religions in the traditions which follow the Ten Commandments, that is Judaism, some forms of Christianity and Islam, were very hesitant to allow their followers to make any kinds of statues of living things, because they were so easily converted into things that should be, that got worshipped in their own right. So these graven images in medicine become the guidelines that tell you to treat everybody to a certain target of blood pressure, a certain HbA1c, a certain level of total cholesterol or triglycerides or whatever it might be. Those are guidances, but in themselves, it's just like graven images are much easier to worship than a distant god that takes no form. They, by doing so, you really miss the point, which is to treat the total patient, both for their life as lived at present and for their risks in the life to come, as it were, their life expectancy. But so let's move swiftly on to number 7.
Number 7, honor thy older patients, for although they often have the highest risk, they may also have the highest risk of harm from treatment.
Yeah, I think we all know this, don't we? And we were talking about heart failure the other week, and it's very, I mean, I've heard a cardiologist stand before an audience, mostly GPs, and say, titrate till they drop, and then come back on their medications, give them the lot right at once. And there is a paper that's just come out which shows that that might actually achieve mortality benefit. I haven't read that properly yet, but it will also make patients keel over by definition, and having falls in the elderly is not a good idea. It's the same with diabetes. A lot of hidden harm from hypoglycemic attacks, which Kasia Lipska in particular at Yale has been uncovering. And so particularly with elderly people who can be tipped into the final phase of life, and a very miserable final phase of life, by falls, by fractures, lying in nursing homes, getting bed sores, becoming demotivated to do anything in life, or simply being unable to do anything in life. Similarly, that can happen if people are so hypotensive that they drag themselves around. They may live longer if they're hypertensive and got heart failure, but on the other hand, they may not be able to do anything that they enjoy. So these simple geriatric points are becoming more interesting to me as time goes on, but they're of interest to all of us because most of our patients do fall into the elderly group if we're in primary care, other than perhaps practices that are dominated by kids. So let's just honor those elderly patients. If they don't like taking pills, let's keep them on as few as possible and perhaps on as low a dose as we can get away with.
What I'll add to that is that I do think there is growing evidence sometimes saying that, as you pointed out, sometimes being more aggressive might be helpful. And that I think age is not the only thing to consider here. Sometimes the frailty, diminishing lifespans, you know, very healthy older patients might benefit from us being more aggressive. And those who are near the ends of their life, I think we have to be more respectful of.
Yeah. Well, I'd go with that. I don't think these are written in stone. Just thinking points, really. So number eight is,
thou shalt stop any treatment that is not of clear benefit and regularly reassess the need for all treatments and tests.
Okay, so this is more on the same lines, I suppose. Now, when you're talking about life-prolonging treatments from randomized trials on asymptomatic individuals or on highly symptomatic individuals, doesn't matter really which, you're often working on the basis of averages, and so you can't judge by clear benefit because benefit isn't clear. So this isn't a particularly well-framed commandment, but it certainly applies if the condition is one where your treatment is largely symptomatic. I would perhaps look at COPD here, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which often isn't particularly obstructive, I might say. It's often characterized by exacerbations caused by infection and so on. And a lot of the treatments for that depend on your reliance on data from pharma-driven trials of various inhaler combinations and so on. So again, the clear benefit is not clear to the patient. They'll never know if they benefited from that, but they will know if you give them something that makes them breathe more easily and have fewer infections. It's perhaps not the ideal example, but that's the sort of thing I'm aiming at. If a patient doesn't feel that their drug is doing much for them, particularly if it's costing them a lot of money, they'll drop it anyway without your review. But you do need to beware of the accumulation of drugs, wield the geriatrician's scalpel, even if the patient isn't geriatric. You've heard of this expression, perhaps in the States. We use it in, or at least geriatricians use it. They compare themselves to surgeons, and they make large incisions into patients' drug lists and end up with a much reduced essential list of medications, whereupon the patient goes off to the cardiologist or the other clinic and gets them all stuck back on. But anyway, we won't go into that. Let's move on because we are running out of time. I think the points are slightly repetitive. Number nine in particular repeats this message, really.
Number nine, thou shalt diligently try to find the best treatment for the individual because different treatments work for different people.
Well, yeah, I kind of, that's a slightly cheaty way of putting it, isn't it? Because we don't know what's going to work for different people in many cases. In symptomatic conditions, we need to find out. I mean, there's no doubt that if you're treating depression, you will have a list of your favorite antidepressants, which may or may not be evidence-based. But you know, you try one out for a month, or within days the patient comes back and says that they can't move, can't sleep, or their mouth is terribly dry, or they're agitated, or whatever, and you try another one. And it's the same to some extent with pain. You've got a limited number of choices, and you've got a patient who will not necessarily respond to the first thing you give them. So that diligence there means saying to them, I believe you, let's try something else, but something that's informed by a knowledge of pharmacology. Whereas trials, well, in these symptomatic conditions, I think you've got really to look at different methodologies, particularly cumulative N of one trials, to get some idea of what these drugs do. It's no good having aggregate population figures. They just generate the list and give you some idea of the possible harms. So that's what I'm saying there. Really, that's all that means. I don't think it applies necessarily right across the board. I think it really applies more to symptomatic treatments.
You know, it's interesting, because when I had read that, I had thought back to some of the earlier points we made about knowing the total level of risk, and a lot of individualizing treatment or personalizing it is saying, you know, you're very high risk. If you have high risk of heart disease, you really should be on a statin. You're very low risk. If you don't really want to take it because your risk is so low, it's reasonable not to take it, those kinds of things. So I think even for non-symptomatic things, things that involve total level of risk prediction, there's some value in individualizing it. But I 100% agree that the biggest area where I really consider this is a lot of empiric approaches to symptomatic conditions. I wish we had a lot more crossover N of one type trials to help us. You know, a lot of times we try to find subgroup data to inform if select patients may be more likely to benefit, then there's just not a lot out there as much as we might wish.
Yeah. So as you can see, and we're nearly out of time, and that's good, because the commandment 10 is slightly a repetition of the ones that went before. You have to make them up to 10, you see, as that's the divine figure.
So, number 10.
Yeah.
Thou shalt seek to use as few drugs as possible.
Well, yeah. Now, do you believe that, Raj? What would your counterexamples be? Because we have talked about this before.
Yes, I have mixed feelings about this, because I sort of agree with the idea, but we have hypertension is the best one, where when I first started training, I would try to pick one drug, and if they weren't controlled, maximize it before considering adding a second one. But we've had numerous trials now coming out suggesting that polypills, where you have lower doses of multiple medicines, might be better tolerated and have equally good blood pressure effects. Because when you go up to maximize the dose of one medication, there's a dose response to adverse effects sometimes, like
yes,
blood pressure, electrolyte.
Almost issues. Always. Yeah, almost and always you get benefit from the low dose, and then the harms yes. come in with a diminishing returns in terms of effect.
So, yep. You know, I'm hesitant to tell people to take lots of pills, but I want to create a caveat here of polypills, which I think are still being studied, and a lot of great research is being done, and maybe there's a future there for that.
Yes. And I'm sorry I interrupted you just then, but it was only to agree, really. And I'm somewhat more of a convert towards the list of basic drugs for people with heart failure and diabetes and possibly high blood pressure, that they should almost always involve polypharmacy, in fact, but carefully judged polypharmacy. And fixed drug combinations possibly are useful in that they save people a lot of hassle and possibly sometimes some money. And so I think that's something where my mind has tended to become more open, which can actually happen sometimes.
We're never too old to change our mind. I will say in your defense, you know, when I have patients that are on 14, 15 medications, all with, you know, different timings of when to take them and things, I'm amazed at when patients can pull it off. I don't know how I would do it myself. I mean, it's a lot to keep a track of. And I do worry as we have patients with so many comorbidities and so many medications, consistent adherence becomes an issue. And so there's just a lot of practical challenges there that we have to consider, even if we have the ideals in the back of our mind.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we've covered these now somewhat aging commandments. If anyone can come up with some better ones, absolutely great. There have been some imitations, I'm glad to say, but they're not imitations of me, they're imitations of Moses on Sinai, so I don't take that as a personal accolade. I'm just glad that these may have stimulated some debate and certainly stimulated a nice conversation with Raj.
It's very good. So do you have a recap or a takeaway after reviewing these 10 commandments, Richard?
No, read them, guys. They're still relevant, even if you don't agree with them. They only cover a page and a half, so you've no excuse. Discuss them and let me know what you think.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.